Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So you chose Livermore, and I know that there's some history there, clearly, as we heard. But it was a deliberate choice, is what you're saying?
It was a deliberate choice.
Okay.
Part of it was, a happy accident in a way. My father, again, going back to this, to the previous generations in California. You go back to the 1960s. Mm-hmm. There were only a handful of wineries that were making premium wine back then.
Yeah.
This is before Napa Valley became the Napa Valley that everybody knows.
Right.
This is before Robert Mondavi, or just the cusp of Robert Mondavi. This is, this is when you had, more sweeter off dry wine being made than dry wine and
right.
sold. This was Chenin Blanc time, off dry Chenin Blanc. This was not world class Cabernet time that we see now in California, and the idea that totally lost my train of thought.
Oh, it's okay.
Good thing you can edit these things.
No.
What was the question
so
again?
So the question was, when you chose Livermore, and it was a deliberate choice, we all have choices. And in your case, you already had some background with wine, and I'm sure you were very wine curious at that stage when you were making a life decision. So what drove you to Livermore, sounds like, is that there was historic precipice, that you really honed in on, and you wanted to make something out of it. Again, you wanted to shape it.
Right. Yes, exactly. I think the family relationship part of things was strong.
Yeah.
And the fact that my family had known the Wente family for generations and the Concannon family for generations, and the sheer fact that Eric Wente, who was running Wente Vineyards at the time in, mm-hmm. in 1984, invited my dad and Yvonne to come up and sort of see what they could offer in terms of winemaking expertise and administrative right. infrastructure and stuff like that, meant that there was a home in Livermore.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time, and this was probably 1988.
Yeah.
So by the time I had gotten here, and it kind of arrived at this decision in 1995, 96, my father and Yvonne were already kind of ensconced in Livermore.
Mm-hmm.
So that happy accident idea is that the family, my immediate family is here in a place that also happens to be able to grow really great Cabernet.
Yeah.
And, at that point in time, four kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, my wife, who had just gone back to teaching at that point in time, and we, relatively young family trying to make our way,
yeah.
Here we are. Why don't we take advantage of the situation that we're in,
sure.
see what we can do to learn, to put, practical time into what we think we know and learn from
yeah.
those mistakes. This was a great place to do that. And economically, a much sounder thing to do than to go to Napa, for instance,
yeah.
at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
The more I look at the wine business now, the more I look at regions and the more I look at what's possible and where I think the markets are going and the things that are most meaningful to me, I'm always intrigued and seeking knowledge. Buying Napa Valley Cabernet and making it here in Livermore and doing
mm-hmm.
something along those lines is probably something that will end up happening.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I want to know whether whether it's a terroir-driven thing, whether it's just, or what part that role really plays. Is the fruit really that much better there than it is in Livermore, or is it a function of other things? But the desire to be in Napa Valley, to have a place in Napa, doesn't interest me at this point in time.
Okay. So you really want to delve into the substantive elements, is it really objectively that much more and delivers, the ensuing product reflects that?
Yes.
That's kind of part of your life.
It's certainly going to be different.
Okay.
There's no question about that. But objectively, being able to look at these things and say, this wine is better than what we're making in Livermore. is something that I'm curious about.
Right.
I think that the Napa Valley brand, again, not a monoculture there, and not this monolith, but enough people are making wine in a style that it has become a brand. Mm-hmm. And that style for me is, you know, has structural elements. It has high alcohol elements. It has more manipulation elements than I'm comfortable or desirous of really working with from a winemaking standpoint. Has that style become so ensconced in people's minds that they can't see past that and see wines of, in my mind, greater complexity, wines that have at least as good, if not better, ageability potential, that have more subtlety, nuance, elegance to them? Those are the wines I prize, mm-hmm. from a drinking standpoint and from a making standpoint. Mm-hmm. So if I wanted to make Stephen Mirisu's style of Cabernet in Napa Valley, it could very well be a fool's errand. You know, why would you go to some place that's been around, you know, really been a force in the business for 50 years now with a very obvious style of winemaking that very much succeeds, mm-hmm. and say, you know what, it's not that they're doing things wrong. That's not my point. The point is that I don't find that interesting. If I were to try to do what I wanted to do there, would it be successful? Would it change people's perceptions of things at all? Or would it be just some guy who decided he wanted to step away from what everyone else was doing and do something different? That's not a reason enough to do something like that in my mind. I think there are places to explore here, vineyards to explore in Livermore. Most of the vineyards here are really young. I'm just really beginning to get a handle on the sites, just beginning to get a handle on how to take that fruit and shepherd it to a style that I love. A constantly evolving style. I taste some of my older wines, and I can't believe what the hell I was thinking 15, 20 years ago. The wines are so oaky and they're so coarse compared to what we're doing now. And I that's a victory as far as I'm concerned. I you know, this idea of trying to perfect yourself on a daily basis is something that appeals to me. You know, trying to be better every day and trying to learn and expand your you know, be open to all of, you know, life's and wine's little miracles that happen on a daily basis is something that profoundly interesting to me. So I appreciate the fact that and applaud the fact, really, I guess, that the wines that we're making now are much different than they were in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. and I think much better.
You know, Napa Valley has experienced such an accelerated rate of growth and awareness. I think it's a phenomenon unto itself, and a lot of people, when I travel around the world, ask me about Napa and what it's really about, and it is kind of a freak of marketing in some ways. You know, you cannot replicate it, and I don't think that there's a need to. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of talk about terroir, and, you know, if you take a deep dive into the glacial activity in Napa, there's certainly a lot of evidence that supports that their terroir and microclimates are as unique as it gets. A lot of people would support that. However, if we were to expand that notion onto every region, I believe that every region believes that their terroir is unique, and they should. It is, in fact, their home and where they make their wine. So wines from Livermore should taste like the land that they're grown in. And I think it sounds simple, yet there's kind of a lot to uncover there, because in fact it is really a perception as well as reality. If you truly believe that this plot of land that you chose to call home, and where you get your hands dirty, and where you spend an inordinate amount of time studying and intimately getting to know that piece, there's that transference of you as a maker and what you make of it, and that's where the style ensues. But I believe that that's a beautiful story in and out of itself. The choices that you made may have been dictated in some respects by practicalities, but at some point, you know, there's other things that kick in, which is you imparting your own values and your personality on the land that you tend to. And I've gotten to know that you have a curious mind, and you're a voracious learner and taster. So from the tasting standpoint, I know that you've mentioned you've virtually drank nothing from California, maybe even the New World. What is it that you taste and why, and has there been any revelatory bottles?
from my perspective, winemaking, some people will say, and I think rightfully so, that red winemaking is about tannin management, ultimately. If you're making Cabernet, it's about how do you manage tannin in such a way that you create an underpinning structure for the wine, potential ageability, a scaffolding for fruit, that sort of thing. I may broaden my kind of definition of what I think fundamentally I do as a winemaker, and consequently what I'm looking for from a tasting standpoint, as structure is the most important thing in wine for me. Mm-hmm. It's not aroma and flavor. Those, obviously, we want things to taste good and to smell good. Mm-hmm. There are some very obvious things that we can do to affect flavor and aroma. None of which are particularly good in my mind. from a structural standpoint, I mean, I'm looking for something that is beautiful. That's kind of fundamentally what I want my wine to be. The wine that I make and the wine that I drink and the wines that I end up liking are wines that are beautiful wines. They're wines that are graceful, mm-hmm. that have elegance to them, that have an appropriate sense of their own whatness or itness. You know, they're of a piece. You know, they're not trying to be something that they're not. They're not trying to be over extracted. They don't want to. They're not trying to slap you upside both head, you know, sides of your face. They're wines that reveal over time. You take one sip, you get something. You take another sip, you get something else. And the more that you dive into that, the more you think about it, the more that wine opens up, the more the world that is that wine opens up and reveals mm-hmm. things, reveals truths about the time of the year, the place, the winemaking philosophy. These things are fascinating to me. You know, there are so many thousands of different inputs. Let me rephrase that. There are scores of inputs that will happen in the course of a winemaking year. Mm-hmm. Literal inputs. Things that we do to manage structure and tannin and to do whatever we need to do. And some of those things will proceed in a direction that you expect them to, sometimes they don't. All very fascinating to me. When we're in the cellar during harvest time, we're fermenting in, you know, 1.5-ton plastic bins, basically. Open top fermenters, hand punching. And as we get through primary fermentation and are deciding when we're gonna press, which is, you know, the second real major decision of the year. Your picking mm-hmm. decision and your pressing decision. We're tasting these wines every day, writing notes, dipping our arms into, you know, through the cap to get a sample, or sometimes the cap's dropped. You know, we've done extended maceration, the cap's been dropped for a couple of weeks before we finally pull the trigger. I'm looking for something. I'm searching for some moment in time where the structure of that wine says to me, this is what I was meant to be. You know, this is kind of the sort of holistic sort of feeling I get about what this wine desires to be, what it can be, kind of what its apotheosis is.
Wow.
You add wood to get something else.
Yeah.
You add bottle age to get something else. But there's when I'm in the cellar, and we've got 30 different bins lined up, and we're going through these bins, you know, sometimes twice a day to finally make this picking decision. There is a moment in time where it's the right, that's it. You know, it will be different in a minute from now, but this is the right time now to press the spin off. This has achieved what it's going to achieve. It is the decisions that we've made up to that point have been right or wrong, or a combination thereof, and now we have an opportunity to to get it to a point where we can sort of massage structure a little bit with barrel choices. Mm-hmm. And there's just something incredible about that time in the cellar. It's a magical thing. It's a magical place to be. It's full of wonder. You know, you took fruit and you smashed it up a little bit and you added yeast to it, or you didn't add yeast to it, whatever, however you end up doing that part of things. And in about 7 days, you've got wine. And a little bit longer after that, you've got wine with some structure to it. You've got wine with some depth to it. And then, you know, 2 years after that, you've put it in the right barrel. Hopefully you've got something, you know, magical. And then bottle age will even, you know, add, and then time and sell. All these things just, when it's really right, you know, it's sort of one magical thing compounded upon the previous magical thing, and you get something, you just say, wow, you know, that's okay. So this is how it's supposed to be. This speaks to me. This will speak to my friends, my family, my customers. This wine will say something about what I believe in as a winemaker. It'll say something about what I believe in as a curious person, as a person who's looking to try to make something beautiful, something that brings joy, something that brings comfort to people, something that will make that day a little bit better than it was before. Though that's a profound gift to be able to give to people, I think, and that's something we attempt to do all the time. It's just, you know, life's hard, and it's hard for all of us. How do we make it a little less hard for people? How can we, through our vehicle, through our creative vehicle, which is wine, which is hospitality service, which is a thoughtful desire to, you know, to create an exceptional experience for people. How do we kind of marshal all those into this experience for guests that come to the winery or what have you, people who bring a bottle of wine to a restaurant? Those are the things that I think about. Those are the things that mean the most to me. And so when I'm tasting other people's wines, mm-hmm. again, to get back to your original question, I'm looking for that kind of emotional reaction too. You know, for me, acidity is a hugely important thing. I tend to taste in a strain, I don't even know how, it just came to me, and it's the way I've been doing this for 25 years now, is that, I taste in this weird way. When I taste wine, I kind of imagine my mouth is sort of this cave. And there's this river of acidity running through this. The wine is sort of this river that runs through this thing. And the length of the cave kind of corresponds to the overall length of the wine. The pace of the river in this cave is the acidity in the wine. The turbulence of the river is tannin. There's a wide cave or a narrow cave, kind of depending upon the overall breadth of and expansiveness of the wine in the mouth. I don't know how this happened. It just popped into my head one day, and it's not even something that I bid. It just happens. Mm-hmm. And that's the way that I feel those kinds of things when I taste. And so I'm looking for that. You know, I'm looking for an appropriately quickly flowing river. I love acid. I love what it does to mm-hmm. the overall freshness in the wine, the overall compatibility with food. I think that acidity and tannin are what allows wines to age, not just tannin. And so wines to me that end up being great wines are wines that kind of fulfill that sort of mouth picture, as it were. You know, I don't have any better way of describing that. That's how I taste. Those are the things I look for. Is a sense of completeness, a sense of, you know, the sculptor has sort of sanded off all the rough corners now and has this thing that's done, you know, that is beautiful, hopefully. You know, that is round where it's supposed to be round and has corners where it's supposed to have corners, and you wouldn't change it at all. Because time's going to change it, you know, and your own personal circumstances and the way you taste and what you're eating, all those things are going to end up changing anyway. But to try to get those moments where you can be sort of, you know, get off this sort of merry-go-round of the way wines age, especially when you're fermenting them, to have one quiet little moment where you don't have to worry about time rushing past you, and you've got a sense of that wine at that moment in time. That's the kind of a fun thing that I look for in the cellar as well when we're in the midst of making this stuff.
Wow, I'm really glad that you described this analogy, because it really goes to show that it's such an highly individualized and phenomenal experience. You get to know yourself. I've heard the wine described in shapes by quite a few people in production and actually marketing as well, and I've always found it fascinating, because even though it could be the same, usually it's a circular shape, so it doesn't have any edges, but they always describe it differently. What you've described, I've never heard before. But this is a great homework assignment for our listeners, that ask yourself what it makes you feel like physically. Mm-hmm. Like, really take your palate for a test drive. We don't even care what you taste, but just get to know what it lands like on you.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, this is audio clearly, so we didn't have the benefit of watching your face when you were describing it. It was so incredible just to watch your eyes change, and you were so animated, not just physically on the outside, but I could see the light in your eyes. I know that this man is absolutely possessed by his craft, just watching you. And another thought leapt to mind when you were talking about actually the very beginning of the fermentation process. So I read a rather scary statistic that the life of a child, you know, basically in the first 18 months, the die is cast as far as personality. 18 months.
That is scary.
It's incredibly scary. It's basically shapes the rest of our lives. The rest is just fleshing it out.
Yeah.
So it made me think about your description of how you're watching this. I mean, the wine starts the moment it hits. I mean, the moment it's collected and hits the fermentation vessel. That's where the life of the wine actually starts. So those first formative moments are crucial. And how you shepherd the wine subsequently, you know, like you said, correcting it or, you know, framing it. But at that moment, you actually, that die will be cast for the vintage, for you, for that specific type of wine. So it has to be kind of awe-inspiring and probably scary. And experience helps, but what is it like?
It is awe-inspiring. That's the best word that I wish I had picked that word out. It is awe-inspiring. It is the fact that, you know, again, this would happen of its own accord if you had a fruit crushed and yeast available, which it always is. It wouldn't be drinkable necessarily.
But it's
gotten less scary. Mm-hmm. Because I realize that one of the crucial things about trying to ensure that this happens well is that you start with really good fruit.
Yeah.
Start with good fruit that's in a ripeness range that makes sense, mm-hmm. that isn't 30 bricks, you know, that isn't ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, that there's, you know, there's some physiological ripeness to the fruit. There's brown seeds. The skins have begun to dimple a little bit, and mm-hmm. You can taste, you can feel the tannin in the skins when you put the grape in your mouth when you're walking through the vineyard. And you know, we inoculate. There are a lot of people who will use native yeast. We do some native fermentations with Chardonnay and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But we have a stable, very small stable of yeast that we like a lot, that work really well with the Cabernet that we work with, and so. I know that, you know, if we add the right amount of yeast to the right amount of volume of juice and fruit, mm-hmm. that we're more than likely going to have a fermentation that goes through without really an issue. And I remember when we first started, you get a little bit of these. Sometimes you get these sort of ethyl acetate, these fingernail polish remover aromas coming from the wines. We don't punch down immediately. You know, we'll do some cold soaking and we'll just pitch the yeast on the top of the cap, let it sit there for a few days, let, you know, whatever did come in off of the fruit start doing its fermentation thing. Those the number of cells is never enough to get the wines dry. You know, this native fermentation idea, it's really the yeast in the environment where you make your wine. There's never enough yeast cells coming in off the skins themselves to get something dry. They will start fermenting though. And there's a lot of sort of Saccharomyces cerevisiae components on the grape skins that will start to ferment and give flavors that will add something to the end product.
Right.
You know, so we get this. We lift the bin lid every day and smell it and make sure that we don't have something crazy going on. Mm-hmm. And if we do, we'll ameliorate it. And maybe we'll start punching down earlier, because once you start getting yeast and CO2 developed, you know, VA issues become less of a problem, and you know, ethyl acetate and stuff like that become less of an issue as you get fermentation going. Active fermentation is a beautiful thing. It covers a lot of sort of potential problems in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, insect issues and just stuff floating around the winery issues that mm-hmm. that can be a problem if you're not, you know, fermenting in an active way. So it's gotten less scary. There's always moments where you taste the, you know, we'll taste every day, as I said, you know, making notes, and one day the wine tastes fine, the next day it tastes not fine, and
yeah.
Okay, what the hell is this now? Mm-hmm. You know, and so there are always surprises. There are always, we've done some native ferments on Cabernet, and every time we've done it, the wines have been have the wine that would normally be, you know, in a very general way, dark cherry fruit, let's just say, is so red and so tart, and it's like from another planet, you know. And in that same plant, though, the Chardonnay ends up being gorgeous.
Yeah.
So it's an odd thing, and I don't really know why that's happened. There's some strain, and generally in wineries there will be a dominant strain or two of yeast, and that's the yeast that will end up getting your wine dry. And maybe the strain that's there in the environment just is not a Cabernet strain that you want to have around.
Yeah.
So that, you know, we experiment with things, and we try to minimize the mistakes that we make. Fruit's expensive. The time it takes to get stuff done is, you know, there's a lot of time involved,
yeah.
and that costs money and all that kind of stuff too. I'm in a certain point in my career now where I get to go along for the ride. You know, we're really kind of shepherding this thing, rather than, we don't want to try to manipulate things too much. I mean, we do 6 different single vineyard Cabernets at Stephen Kent, 6 different sites, you know, about a 9-mile axis from east to west in Livermore. They're all different, they're all interesting, and the more we muck around in the process, the less they show themselves.
Yep.
And so we try, young winemakers, I think, they want to do something. You know, they want to winemake. When what you really just need to do is just relax a little and taste and smell and let things take their course, because they generally will take their course in a way that is, you know, at least creates the foundation for something that can end up being really nice. Again, good fruit, much greater chance of good wine at the end of the day.
You know, wine business gets romanticized quite a bit. Clearly, it's not only hard work, but I think one of the most instructive pieces I just heard from you is that it's very much alive. It's a creature that you know, develop a relationship with, and hopefully you play well together, and sometimes it rebels, just like, you know, a young child.
Exactly.
So that relationship is precious, because the end result is that if you let it, it will develop its own personality. And fundamentally, that's the difference between mass-produced wines that are all made in a homogeneous manner, and that's how they're meant to be made, and wines of character that they show up with, and that it's your role as a shepherd, as a parent, however you want to label it, to actually let the best qualities come forward.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.